A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Hidden Histories. For today's episode, I spoke to Emily Cock, who researches disability and disfigurement in the early modern period. And more specifically, we talked about the 17th century, the result of the Civil War on veterans, and some of the characters that emerged during the Restoration period. Much like other histories, disability history is in the process of being recovered, so speaking to Emily was enlightening and surprising. I hope you enjoy this podcast, and please do check out the show notes for links to what we discuss. Emily Cock, welcome to Hidden Histories.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast because you research an incredibly interesting subject, which is disability and disfigurement in the early modern period. I'm really interested in starting to, I know you research so much around this period, and it's a very, very vast period of history, but I just wanted to hone in a bit on your research into the Civil War to start with, because the Civil War had a massive impact on disability, because am I right in thinking that it was the first major conflict, certainly, you know, within England and Britain, the first major conflict that involved so much heavy artillery, therefore that resulted in massive injury?
I think you must know more about artillery than I do. I could neither confirm nor deny that. We've certainly got sort of lots of veterans beforehand, and, you know, any medievalist will come forward with really dramatic injuries and people sort of surviving with all sorts of embodiment. But you certainly do see sort of en masse veterans having to be supported, perhaps in a way that the British nations hadn't had to deal with before that point.
So somebody that you research in quite a lot of detail is the character of Thomas Fairfax. So he was a parliamentarian leader, general of the...
Yes, general.
A general. And so he was... I had no idea that Fairfax was disabled. I mean, how did he become disabled, and how was that managed?
Okay, so I think it's kind of worth kind of picking up the term disabled just to start, so we're sort of on the same page, because it's quite contested as a term to apply to the early modern period and even today. So I use what's called the social model of disability, which sort of separates out the physical sort of impairment or the fact of difference around the body or the mind, and the sort of barriers and social treatment that turns that physical or mental difference into a disability. So the sort of the classic example is sort of someone who has some kind of bodily impairment that means they use a wheelchair, and then that is turned into something that is disabling because the world is set up for people who don't use wheelchairs. And so that kind of disability can be addressed and in a sense lessened by sort of putting ramps in buildings and those sorts of things. There's many different kinds of models and sort of criticisms around that. So critical disability studies sort of points out quite rightly that there are certain types of embodiment and sort of facts about physical and mental difference that society can't fix. So pain is sort of a classic one. So when we talk about sort of Fairfax as a disabled figure, he is in a way sort of another figure of that period with exactly the same kinds of physical sort of differences about their body wouldn't be. So we have to kind of dig down into that a little bit. So Fairfax was a very lead from the front general. He gets injured quite a lot. There's one point where he gets sort of slashed across the face with a sword. So he develops a very striking facial scar, which it sort of shows off in all of his portraits after that point. It becomes quite a popular thing for, you know, sort of men with dramatic war wounds will sort of show them off. If they can be kind of neatly presented, it's It's a fine line to draw in terms of going, look at how manly and brave I have been, but also sort of it can still be kind of civilly presented to the viewer in portraiture. But later in life, he also develops gout. Most medical historians will sort of say it's probably gout. There may have been other things and sort of old injuries playing up. It's always a bit hard to tell. But he starts to use a wheelchair sort of quite late in life. So in terms of being sort of a disabled figure, whether that's sort of his facial difference or the fact he uses a wheelchair, that's sort of something that sort of occurs at different stages over his life.
So the fact you've seen his wheelchair, haven't you?
I have.
And the fact that it survives, I think, is pretty amazing, because does that suggest that this type of device was uncommon during the period, or does it suggest that it was treated with a sense of reverence because it was attached to Thomas Fairfax? I mean, I'm quite intrigued as to how the wheelchair itself became an object that has survived all of this time, and it's how that has been attached to him.
That is a good question. So as far as I know, the wheelchair stayed in the family. So I saw this at the Civil War Museum in Newark in 2018, and it was part of an exhibition on sort of Civil War medicine, and it had sort of his boots, and I think there was a sort of a flask, it was sort of a few bits and pieces that belonged to him, but the chair very much dominated the room. It's quite large, and you can find images online if you just sort of Google. But they were definitely not common during the period. We sort of only know of a couple, sort of a few sort of here and there, and they tend to be quite elite figures. So Louis the 17th? who's the big Versailles Louis?
One of the Louis.
One of the Louis. So one of the Louis uses one, and he's sort of able to do that because he has his grand gardens and sort of laid out pathways. And, you know, if there's anyone who is able to alter an environment to suit a wheelchair, it is going to be the King of France. So no, they are definitely rare objects. And it is very interesting that the family sort of chose to keep this, if I'm right, that it has stayed within the family for all these years.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's amazing. But what can the wheelchair tell us about how people with physical disabilities or impairments, how they manage daily life? You talk about these sort of, about the Palace of Versailles and things being put in place and structures being changed in order to accommodate people. Was that sort of thing happening during this period in England as well? Is this wheelchair demonstrative of that, do you think?
Not generally. So I think he is able to use the wheelchair within the, I don't know whether he used it outside the house, whether it was just within the house. So it's Appleton House by this stage. It's the more modern Appleton House. They redo it. They replace the medieval building, which was quite pokey, apparently. But, you know, having nice smooth floors, nice wide doors. You know, if you were sort of further down the social scale, that's much harder to achieve. But there is interesting work being done around Bath in particular, as sort of a city that going into the 18th century is very much catering for essentially a disabled population. It's going, if you are ill, if you have any kind of physical impairment, come to us. And so there's sort of interesting work being done around sort of the landscaping and the public kind of spaces of Bath as very much set up for sedan chairs or any kind of mobility aid, because that's the population that they're targeting.
That's really interesting, because I actually grew up not far from Bath, and I was always told that the pavements were really wide to accommodate the width of women's skirts. But perhaps it was to accommodate sedan chairs and wheelchairs, you know?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, during this period, were disabilities acknowledged and ability taken into account? So was it accommodated for? Were people treated with equality? Or do you think that this was a case of an able-bodied man's world?
Ooh, that's quite a big question. And it is something that sort of is being investigated a lot more. So there isn't a category of disability in the way that it sort of operates as a category now, you know, can be a protected characteristic or anything like that. You can sort of see particular instances where it's having to be sort of addressed administratively. So the people who are petitioning for support after the Civil War is a kind of a good example. They're having to prove that they are physically incapable of sort of supporting themselves and their families anymore. And they're sort of in need of particular support or particular accommodations. We might use that term. But it's also sort of more philosophically, there's a broader understanding about all bodies within a Christian mindset, all bodies as sort of infirm post the fall. None of us are perfect. So, I mean, it's not a glory age of physical difference, but there are sort of more accommodations around these things. It's one of the reasons it's a really interesting period to sort of be looking at historically and looking at disability, because we really don't know so much of this and what people's experiences were really like.
Yeah, so it's not a case of it needing to be like Sparta, but then it's also not quite a case of everybody being catered for equally as well. I imagine, of course, if people were, especially people who were labourers or especially prior to the war, physically unable to work, therefore earn money, I imagine that these petitions were largely for income.
Yes, they do tend to be. And they tend to be quite emphatic about the different ways that they've been trying to earn income. So a case I quite like is one by a man called Thomas Calverley, who loses both feet in a battle. So he petitions for, he's part of a group of soldiers, and they petition in part for some money so they can rent a horse so that he can travel home. And he pops up a little bit later, and it transpires that he has been supporting himself as a scribe. So, you know, he can't do physical work anymore. So he works as a scribe, and it's only when his eyesight fails and he can no longer support himself as a scribe that he then asks for admission to an almshouse and that extra level of support. So Arise Evans, it's a wonderful name for a prophet. He's just born as Rhys Evans, and it's a little bit of a fuzzy bit in the historical record to the extent to which he chooses Arise or whether the sort of English people were mispronouncing his Welsh name. But he goes, actually, Arise works, I'll stick with Arise, because he becomes a prophetic writer. He is born in Merionethshire in Wales, but he travels off to London and starts receiving visions, which he then publishes, sort of saying, first it's foretelling that the civil wars will come, then it's sort of foretelling what's happening. And being a good royalist, he quite often then has visions sort of suggesting that the king will or should win, and then when that doesn't happen, that Oliver Cromwell should sort of do all he can to bring Charles II over. He does suggest Charles II marrying one of Cromwell's daughters, which would have been interesting. So he gets a little bit of trouble, and he's quite well known to sort of medical and disability history for the fact that he's sort of been read as someone who is mentally ill. So his visions, it's sort of older scholarship that's like, did he have schizophrenia? Those sorts of questions. And he is actually essentially locked up at one point by sort of friends of the family who are concerned that he is sort of spreading treasonous assertions within his visions. But I came to Arise Evans because after the restoration of Charles II, he has some kind of growth or sort of infection maybe in his nose. And he sort of comments that sort of 1659, that his face has changed quite dramatically, that his sort of neighbours are commenting on it and they don't recognise him. And he has a vision that the king can cure it. So he tries to seek out Charles II. He first tries to go through sort of the more formal admission process to be touched for what's called the king's evil, sort of scrofula. So there were formal ceremonies, you know, once a week where all the people who were suffering from this particular condition could line up at the Palace of Whitehall and be touched by the king, quite literally. He would sort of put his, you know, there would be prayers, there would be anointments, then he would lay hands on the generally the neck of the sufferer, and that would cure this particular condition. And this was something that the monarchs had been doing sort of back into medieval period. Yeah.
Comes with a sort of washing of the feet and things as well, I think.
Yeah. It starts to form a really kind of, it's a really important sort of point where the king sort of meets the common people. And Charles II very much seizes on this as sort of a nice kind of bonding exercise, essentially.
Don't get rid of me. I'm okay. Yeah.
But yeah, there's a big backlog. There's crushes of people who have been waiting through the whole interregnum, and he's finally back. So they're, you know, banging on the door. There is one account of literally someone being crushed to death by the crowd trying to get in, unfortunately. But Arise is actually denied entry to the formal ceremony. And it's a bit hard to tell whether it's because the king surgeon didn't think this one was king's evil, and so, you know, we don't want you rocking up because if you're not cured, then that looks bad. It's bad publicity. Or whether his kind of reputation for madness and kind of imposing himself on people mean that they kind of want to keep him away from the public. Yeah. So he ends up sort of taking the more informal approach, knowing that Charles will be in St. James Park doing his kind of parades, and sort of approaching him more informally to be touched on the nose by the king, which does cure him. So he was right the whole time.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
It does cure him. I mean, so particularly facial disfigurement, whether that comes via means like Thomas Fairfax having the scar across his face, or whether it's something else, illness related or birth. What were the suspicions and in turn diagnoses around these sorts of disabilities?
A lot of the time it depends very much on what kind of backstory is attached to the particular disfigurements. So something I've looked at quite a lot is nasal disfigurement and its association with syphilis, because that can cause sort of the collapse of the nasal cartilage. Also, if you treat it with mercury, that can also cause all sorts of problems. And nose reconstruction is one of those things that is available, but they don't do it. So I've sort of looked quite a lot about why that was the case, but also the weird kind of myths and stories that become attached to this particular kind of nose reconstruction technology. But it causes interesting sort of circumstances. So another Civil War sort of facial injury is the Earl of Arlington, whose portrait is in the National Portrait Gallery. You can go and see it. And the thing you will notice, or at least the thing that I noticed as a nose person, is he's got the little tiny strip of velvet over his nose. And it turns out that it's covering a scar from the one skirmish that he was involved in during the Civil War when he was fighting on the Royalist side. And when Charles II comes to the throne, he sort of starts to wear this patch as a way of kind of drawing attention to the fact that he, you know, I was injured in your father's service, Your Majesty. And this kind of works for a little bit while he's in favour, and then he sort of starts to slip, and the courtiers start putting patches over their nose and sort of dandying about the court to mock him. So in that sense, he's he sort of tries to take control over the story of his body and emphasise, you know, I have served the king, etc. And then it's sort of turned into a disabling physical feature, you know, once the others kind of take control of the story. But I think he doesn't want to push it too far because, you know, he doesn't want to suggest there's too much damage to his nose just in case syphilis starts to sort of be rumoured.
Sure. I think he trod very carefully there. He managed to just get there just about right amount of coverage.
Yeah. Don't want people thinking of William Davenant.
No. But that's fascinating in itself, this idea that, you know, disability used as a sense of personal propaganda. You know, kind of, it's a little bit like the idea of, I don't know if I feel like there's somebody in history who had an eye patch and therefore eye patches became fashionable, but that it could just be completely my imagination.
Ooh, it rings a vague bell, but now I'm
I feel like there's somebody and that became like a trend or something. So how are people treated socially with disabilities? And that's a more of a broader question. So, you know, we could talk about that in the sense of facial disfigurement to begin with. Were people shunned, or was it something that was considered the norm?
It is a good question. It's kind of one of the big questions that sort of driven all of my research on this. One of the things that actually has slightly struck me, I guess, was when I was looking at cases of or surgical records around scrofula, so the King's Evil, which, like I said, sort of appears on the neck and sort of causes, it's quite a visible sort of scarring and sort of tumour, I guess, would be a reasonable kind of description on the neck. And the length of time that people waited before they went and sought treatment. So it would be a visible thing. It's on the neck rather than the face, but I sort of read these areas as kind of in conjunction with each other. And people are sort of, you know, waiting several years and will only go to see the surgeon once it becomes painful. So in terms of sort of going about their daily life with a visible difference, it doesn't really seem to have bothered them. I suppose a good flip side of that is then sort of looking at some of the surgeons' writings, and any time they have to deal with the face, there's really good evidence in sort of the surgical manuals about the level of care that they will take to prevent sort of more scarring, to sort of maintain movement. So, you know, making sure they don't cut, well, what we would sort of know were nerves, or sort of stopping burns. So the extent to which they sort of work to prevent either more disfigurement or to sort of stop whatever disfigurement might have been occurring without their intervention, certainly suggests that there's at least a little bit of pressure sort of coming from the patients to prevent disfigurement.
Which is interesting in this period, because the sort of phrase warts and all comes to mind, because obviously Oliver Cromwell was quite famously painted with his warts on his on mm-hmm. his forehead. I think I'm the right thing, it was his forehead.
Yeah, he's got a few.
Yeah. So it is interesting. That's interesting in itself. It's like, how much was this idea of perfection, or, you know, unity with other people, how much that was considered as an important factor, or whether it was more about, as with the case that you just mentioned with the I forget his name, was it the Earl of Arlington? The Earl of Arlington with his nose patch. Was it a case of demonstrating a sense of duty or a sense of service in some way? There are two different things at play there. So you're saying that it was a combination of both?
Yeah, because I mean, you sort of have to remember that most people are wandering around with, you know, smallpox scars, they're all sorts of things are sort of on their face at this point. So there's a level of acceptance around it. Sort of everyone has something going on, but it's just kind of where those lines start to appear that's kind of fun to tease out. In regard to Cromwell, I mean, Laura Knoppers would be sort of the big person who's written quite a lot about Cromwell and portraiture, and sort of his sort of presentation as a very conscious man of the people, sort of like honest facade. Honest facade? No, that's not the right word. Sort of an honest presentation, which you know, is as much of a self-styling kind of self-identification thing as having the perfect skin, sort of, you know, Elizabeth putting filler in to sort of cover the smallpox scars. It's all, you know, conscious portraiture. No portrait painting is ever an accident.
Yeah, exactly. So it is, so, you know, as you quite rightly say, there's going to be a lot of people walking around with things like with smallpox scars, because the availability to medication and you know, surgery just was not on the scale that it's nowhere near the scale that it would be even in the sort of 200 years that followed. So what sort of, I mean, you did talk a little bit about some of the surgeries that went on. What sort of treatment was available to people who had any sort of physical, either disfigurement or disability?
Well, I suppose sort of I'll keep with the face for sort of narrowing that slightly, if we look at any kind of recipe books, so, you know, guides to housewifery are absolutely bursting with sort of washes for, you know, to get rid of freckles, to get rid of excess hair, to get rid of wrinkles, to clear the skin, to, you know, brighten the skin, to lighten the skin. It's all there. You know, if they had oil of Olay, they would have been fine. So there's very much like they're all doing this. They're washing, they're sort of they're going to the barbers. It's like that, all of that level of kind of body work, to use this modern term, is absolutely there. There's been lots of work around the levels of care and service that barber surgeons and even sort of out to apothecaries and physicians would be giving in what's called the medical marketplace. You know, if you want it, you can get it.
Yeah, that's fascinating that it's actually not much has changed. And I mean, I feel like there could be some kind of circular sense of, you know, natural products that were very popular in the 17th century. You can make a lot of money on those today.
Lemon juice is apparently very good.
Emily, where can people read more about this? Because I feel like it's something that is, you know, it's not a widely discussed subject. As I mean, in many cases, you could argue disability is not a widely discussed subject. So when we're looking at disability in history, that is, I feel like there's a lacuna there, especially for public knowledge. Where would you point people to? And that doesn't necessarily have to be in literature. It could be, as you talked about, going to the Civil War Museum.
I think one of the real kind of advantages of the pandemic actually has been the lever at which academic talks have been put online. So there's actually an amazing amount of disability history on YouTube now, or Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. you know, I've been listening to sort of talks and presentations from all over the world. Places like the Folger Library have been hosting all sorts of talks, which have been great. Organisations like English Heritage have had big projects on sort of properties that they own, and looking at where sort of disability history can kind of fit with there. They've got lots of stuff on their website, actually. And I think sort of National Trust have started doing that as well. So there's definitely a lot more that is starting to be made publicly accessible, particularly since sort of disability history in and of itself has quite a sort of public-facing and, you know, often quite activist agenda. So it's very much about putting people back into history who quite often traditionally have not been there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is certainly at the moment, I think there's a big surge to recover some of these voices. So it's great to know that YouTube, the wonderful YouTube that I think a lot of us are using at the moment, is one particular source that you can go to. Thank you so much, Emily, for coming on the podcast. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Oh, it's been lovely. Thank you.